All right. Well, why don't we get started? So this session will kind of continue some of the theme that Greg told us about this morning, talking about direct electron detectors. And I think, as everyone appreciates, you know, they're not just the latest new toy for electron microscopy, that these have been fundamentally game-changing for the entire field. And Greg sort of went into a lot of the details about why this is. And so what we're going to try to do in this session, that there's a set of questions that the speakers are going to try to, you know, pick amongst. These were actually contributed by WA, so thank you so much, WA, to try to talk about practical aspects related to these detectors. And then after each of the speakers comes up and gives a quite short presentation, then the floor will be open for broad questions for all the speakers related to this, okay? And we can pull up chairs so everybody can be up here at the same time. So beforehand, I just want to kind of repeat some of, you know, a few points from Greg, his talk that, you know, all the detectors, all these new direct detectors provide a huge leap forward. You know, that this is where, you know, those of us who like to use electronic detection had been for many years, the US 4000. As you can see, there's really very poor transfer, especially at even moderate resolution compared to physical Nyquist. It's clear why film had been the detector of choice. But now all three of these commercially available detectors, the DE20, the Falcon 2, we heard about the upcoming Falcon 3, and the K2 from Gatan, you know, represent quite significant improvements over all this. And of course, you know, the high sensitivity afforded by direct detection, the, you know, not having the scintillator itself be a major noise source, and because the signal is so strong, the effective readout noise from these detectors is essentially nil. And so that combined with the high frame rates, which enables movie mode to do drift corrections, these are really the things that have been, you know, so game-changing. I should point out that the Falcon 2 DE20 and film curves were from Greg Wazi and Richard's recent paper. The K2 curves were contributed by Paul Mooney. They're slightly different than Greg's, but I think the point is, you know, in terms of exactly where the crossover is, and this represents that K2 is now available with a somewhat thinner detector that gives a bit better DQE at high spatial frequency. But, you know, I think the point is that, you know, these are all tremendous improvements. And, you know, in looking forward to the future, as Greg indicated, that, you know, the one real remaining noise source is that of the differential electron deposition that each electron contributes. And so while, you know, the average electron may contribute a certain amount of energy, this energy spread that, you know, Greg talked about is a big deal and is a major noise source. And so that some electrons are contributing, you know, down at about 10% of what the mean is, others are contributing at 10x what the mean is, and hence would be counted as 10 electrons in integrating detector, and these would be ignored. Okay, and so that the whole goal of a counting system is to place some threshold, obviously as low as you can go, safely within whatever the noise limits of the camera are, and to then count all these as single events. And so this greatly improves the DQE. It virtually eliminates noise, and then as you've heard in the past from many people, and Greg also mentioned, that the ability of now detecting an electron cloud, you can do image processing, and you can try to determine the centroid of that cloud to get improved resolution. Okay, and sort of the net result of that is that you get information transfer beyond physical Nyquist, and so then the question is this good for anything? And depending on, you know, what your comparison is or how much dampening of the signal you feel you can tolerate, it gives you the option of going to somewhat lower magnification. So instead of being at 1 angstrom per pixel, for example, you could be at 1.25 angstroms or something lower. And so, that would help to give you effectively a larger field of view. Okay. The other thing which John Rubinstein pointed out, you know, very nicely this morning, is that all these detectors actually have significant transfer up to physical Nyquist, and as a consequence, there's aliasing of information and noise from beyond physical Nyquist into the observable region. And so instead of just, either truncating it, either just accepting it, or even worse, as John was talking about, if you're binning, you know, sort of truncating elsewhere, if you Fourier filter, then you can completely, you can minimize the contribution of any of these terms, and super resolution provides a framework for allowing you to do that very efficiently. And so you shouldn't just bin the data, you should always Fourier filter with some kind of roll-off or at least truncation. Okay, and as Yifan will talk about coming up, that another issue with a counting detector is that you have coincidence losses at higher dose rates, and so this is very much a potential downside. But nonetheless, this big enhancement in DQE at low resolution, I think in the end, I agree with Greg, is that in the future, all detectors will have to be counting detectors, and it's then a question of how do we solve all these other problems to give the best information. Now, one thing I might, for a discussion point, sort of quibble with Greg at one point is that in my view, that in terms of what the signal here is, that, you know, in a counting detector, to the extent that you've done it with this quantum efficiency, you've detected the electron. And then really this roll-off comes from, have you put it in the right pixel in terms of where you're counting it, okay? And because it's really a probability distribution and you're assigning it to a pixel, you make errors and hence you get a fall-off. But this is a B factor. And this, to me, I think this is really quite sharpenable because you've already detected the electron. There's no noise. It's just now a question of exactly what the B factor is. And so it's a sort of a different view, I think, than Greg has, and maybe we can talk about that or not. One other comment I want to make is that, there have been comments that have been bandied about with, for example, one only needs a K2 for particles smaller than X Daltons, right? And in the end, it's hard to say why that would be, why there would be some threshold here, and that the reality is that all this information at, 5 to 8 or even lower angstrom resolution is what we're using for all aspects of, really for alignment of movie frames, for particle alignment, for classification, etc. And the more signal to noise you can have in this region, the better all of those operations are, right? So, it's really not what's happening out here, which is sort of a B factor. I think it's really what's happening in here. Now, all of us want this line to be up here and not down here, right? And so that's clearly a future goal, is to get around the decreases here due to coincidence loss and all the other effects that Greg mentioned. So there's clearly room for significant improvement, but I don't think it's appropriate to say that we don't care about this resolution or this sensitivity improvement in this zone. Okay? Now, the other thing is, I think I just wanted to make two more points before turning it over to the speakers. One is, and these are just practical issues that we've been dealing with at UCSF. Of course, everyone appreciates from movie mode, especially if you start sampling very finely in time. The hope is from sort of algorithms like Shor's and what John Rubinstein talked about, that we'll be able to get to even smaller and smaller time events so that we can correct closer to the early data in what's normally in our first few frames to try to get even more high resolution data. So in counted movies, at least, for example, with the dose rates used on a K2, that, really, you, for the most part, you're counting 0, 1, and 2, and, if you want to have headroom, maybe you count up to 4 to 6, but we certainly don't need 32-bit data to represent, a count to 4, right? Now, Gitan, just as a practical issue, right, because we're all trying to deal with these vast amounts of data and store them because we may want to come back to them, with improved polishing programs in the future, that, you know, Gitan offers an 8-bit mode, but where normally the output, even in counted mode, is 32 bits. And we are now compressing that to 4 bits, so there's a quite substantial reduction in terms of data storage. The one challenge is that there's a gain correction that is done post-counting to deal with sort of quantum efficiency variations across the chip and bad pixel fixing, that these you have to do afterwards. And so we store this information in an extended header of the file, so it's always there with the movies, and then can be corrected on the fly. And, you know, we do all this on GPUs, so it's extremely fast and you don't notice the headroom, but it does give you a significant compression for data storage. The other thing to mention, and I think Greg brought this up before, is that, you know, another potential challenge of counting mode is it shows all the blemishes everywhere, right? And that he talked about noisy pixels. There are pixels that are, you know, when you do your gain calibration, that are hot pixels or whatever, or have different gain factors. But there are also pixels that vary statistically in time. And so having done all the normal corrections, if you sum up, this is 150 stacks, so, you know, 4,500 frames, you see both bright and dark spots all across the image, you know, so in the order of like 20,000 of these or so. If you look closely at them from like stacks, sum of stacks from the first 10 images, the next 10 images, or the ones after that, you see many of these spots are in common, but many are different. And so they're varying in the time course of, you know, one image to the next in your data collection. And so to deal with this, that just points out things. So we've written, you know, GPU code that on the fly builds these up in sort of a running series of stacks, identifies the spots, and corrects them, you know, nicely, and so that they're not around to perturb your sums. Now, the biggest place where the, you know, these sorts of more static features affect you is in the frame alignments or in doing tomography, where you have, you know, very low signal to noise, because obviously, you know, any drift that you have will decohere these, and so the spots won't be obvious. And if you just look at a normal image, especially one that's been motion corrected, you don't notice these, but they are intrinsically there, and they are affecting the quality of the potentially the motion correction and other things. Okay, so that's all I want to say, and now let me turn it over to Yifan and to the rest of the speakers, and we'll start going through them. Now, hold your questions, and let's you know, let everybody, because everybody's doing these as short little vignettes, and then we'll all come up and have questions afterwards. So, thanks.
And Walt gave a made a list of questions, and then I pick up the easiest one. So basically, the question is how to select the best microscope parameter, and then to match the camera you're using. So in terms of a microscope parameter, is that you cannot change the microscope. You have to use whatever the microscope you're using. Basically, the magnification, the dose, and the frame number, and then those kind of things for target resolution, and why this is so for the chosen camera. So this is a Walt's question. Now, as we know, that there are three different cameras out there, from DE, and then from Falcon, and from FEI Falcon camera, and the K2 from Gitan. So in UCSF, we have only K2 camera from Gitan. So our experience is mostly on this one, but in principle, that it's very easy to think about other things. So the things to think about is that for all the cameras, that we definitely need to look at the DQE, because then all the DQE now is pretty good. So it's not a major difference there. And then about DQE, it's sort of like a influence of how you think about your data collection, where you want to get most of the signal out of when you change the magnification and so on and so forth. And then also the camera pixel size. And then this one actually had some influence on the how you selected the magnification. Then you to match the pixel size of the your image, and then to match the design resolution you're targeted one. Just like John mentioned in the morning, that in the Fourier transform there, you can easily estimate it from the pixel size there, and then to figure out what is the target pixel size on the specimen you wanted to figure out what's the magnification. But then it became actually more complicated for that one. And now, of course, then the camera mechanism, all these three camera that at least that DE and the Falcon are integrate camera, and K2 is a counting camera, or it can run on the integration, but we only use in the counting mode. And then, so this also influences how you set up these things. And then, of course, for the microscope, it's actually related also to the magnification beam setting and then dose rate and then this so on and so forth. Now, for the DQE, as we can see that this was the same one that Greg showed this morning. And K2 has a very strong low-frequency DQE, which certainly help you for the getting the image contrast and the image for the... which is will help you for the alignment. And but other than that, all this camera has very good DQE. And for K2, the benefit is that, you know, this DQE is quite strong, even actually extending to the super resolution. At the potential, you can actually use the information to the super resolution pixel. And for single particle EM, we hardly ever do that. But for 2D crystal, and it's possible to actually use that information beyond the physical Nyquist. And Tom Watt's lab did some tests recently, and together with us, we did it together, that using the 2D crystal, and then you can see that the spots extending to the super resolution, that which is quite nice. And then for that, basically means that you can use camera with a much larger, recording much larger area, became really like an 8K camera. So those are the one thing that, but besides that, K2, camera is still special, that because it has a smaller, I don't remember the exact number, but it's the smallest pixel size in all three camera. And then to match that one, then which requires using the K2 camera at a relatively lower magnification than the other one. Now this comes with particularly for Tecnite microscope, had some issues with it because the microscope performance is not really that great at a low magnification, and compared with high mag. And then the other thing related to this is certainly exposure time and then the dose rate on the camera. And then these two camera, because it's counting, is an integration and with the counting, so there's also a major difference there. So what counting for K2, the main issue one have to think about is the coincidence loss. And this is the power spectrum of the camera recording without specimen, just basically white noise picture, and do Fourier transform. This will give you noise spectrum. Now, this is the first one is at around like one count per pixel per second. You can see this is almost like a flat one. But then as you go in higher and higher dose rate, what you see is that you can see that the lower frequency has slightly this deep. And then once you go to 20 electron, and it really has seen a major drop here. And then this is caused by the coincidence loss. And then another curve to look at is this one. This is the converting the how many electron input dose per electron and generating the counts. And how many income electron and how many you actually counted. So, for example, if we look at the 10 electron at this level, that we actually, if you count it around like eight electron, you actually have 10. So you lost about like roughly around like 20%. And then the electron are lost here. And then this is actually corresponding to the one of the things that to this loss here. And this is a one thing that one have to keep in mind. Because what the consequence of this one is that this drop of the of this power spectrum and the low frequency is it reduces the image contrast. So, but this phenomena we see this that when you're really using a high dose rate above 10 or above 10, you start to notice this difference. Another thing you can see that is that if you're in a Fourier transform, you see your central portion of the fluid transform became darker and darker if you go higher dose rate. But below 10, this is really tolerable. We don't really see any difference. And but of course, the DQE is also related to this dose rate, that with the lower dose rate, then your DQE actually improves and better. So and that's the one thing that you have to keep in mind. But with this thing in mind, that then this is related to how you set up the electron microscope, how you set up the, your magnification and exposure time. So these are the few numbers we used in our system. We use a this is for the particular setting for the Polara. So for the Polara, the settings that we want is targeted for less than we want. Sorry. We want to use roughly around this level, and 10 electron per pixel per second. This is on the camera, not on the specimen, on the camera. And then you use this as our target dose rate or below. So we certainly normally don't want to go over this one. So if you think about it, at this level, that in the Polara, if we typically are UCSF, we're typically using this for single particle work, we typically use this 31,000 magnification. At this magnification, the pixel size is about 1.2 angstrom per pixel. And this is 1.2 angstrom per pixel, this is at the specimen area. So then if you have this at 10 electron per pixel per second on the camera, so this corresponding to a roughly around like 7 electron per square angstrom per second at the specimen. And if you want targeted, like say 20 electron per square angstrom on your specimen, then you roughly really need about 3 second exposure to get this one. And then at the 3 second exposure, if you take your frame, we certainly want the frame to be as fine as possible so that we can still do the motion correction. That in this system, that at 0.2 second per frame. And then it's the level that we can still do very well motion correction. We can actually do one level below, but it became the total amount of data is much too much is too much to handle. So at this level, 5 frames per second, and you can see that if you use 3 seconds, you get about 15 frames. But this is exactly like the 20 electron, and we now typically use much longer exposure to using higher dose, so that you can boost up your low frequency information, that because as John mentioned in the morning, that once you use higher dose, that you lose high frequency information, but you still gain in the low frequency, then you can use him much stronger image contrast for image alignment. And once by the end of the day, in the final reconstruction, you just can get by waiting or get rid of those later frame. So we typically now at least taking 6 second exposure. And then you're using about 30 frame, or sometimes even go to slightly higher, and 8 seconds. Now, imagine that the things that, as I mentioned, that the dose rate will be lower, the better for the coincidence loss. So if you lower this one to half, to 5 electron, then everything you need to really double. Second, typically you would want probably 15 second exposure. That's become much longer in the exposure time. But then, Because even at this level, your per dose on the camera, that your signal noise ratio at the camera level is actually not as good as this one, because your dose rate is reduced. So the frame rate, keep 5 frames per second, is probably the minimum, the lowest you can go. And typically, you probably were getting like 3 frames or so per second. So anyway, the number of frame, total frame, will be much, much larger. And then ABC transporter paper we just published, that data set was collected at 20,000 mag. Because back then, the idea was that we try to use lower magnification so that it can cover a larger area, and then you can still try to use this super resolution information there. But then turned out to be slightly problematic, because one of the things is that if you use lower than like 20,000, then my pixel size became 2 angstrom per pixel, a specimen. If I still keep this around the 10, and per specimen, at the specimen area, that per second, the dose rate is very low. And then I now need to use much long exposure time. And then my frame rate is much a larger number of frame. And then this is making the data, the total amount of data is much harder to handle. And then particularly if you use 16 seconds, it became harder to deal with it. So this, now we hardly ever use this condition anymore. We typically use this one. But then the ideally you would think that you were better off to go one step up. And then this, go to in the Technoprolo, that another level is a 39K above this one. This gives you about ideally like around like one angstrom per pixel. So this would be really actually the one that it would be ideal case. And then using this same setting, and you can see that you have a much lower number of frame. And then you can actually, the ideal way is that you can even lower this one to 5 electron. Then you have something you can really manage it. So this would be an ideal case. However, the Technoprolo has a problem that at 39,000 magnification, that the projection lens, one of the lens was turned off. And because of this turning the power off of this particular lens, that you have a very severe loss in the contrast transfer function in the high frequency. So this is actually turned out to be a mag that which is difficult to use. But the problem for the Technite is also that above this one, it became 60,000. It's almost like a double of this mag. It became too hard to use. So this one is an unfortunate situation, because otherwise this would be an ideal one for using for this particular case. And we once tried to using the free lens control to really bring up the power of that specific lens, and then it also make the alignment other things became harder. We gave up later, so we just right now stick with this one. Now this is basically the things for the how we did this in the Parola and with the K2 camera. But with other camera, you could think about it's a similar principle to set up the scenes and then set up the scope parameter and then do the scenes. But another gain actually here is that if you go higher mag, the beam you want became very weak. And then this is particularly for the Technite scope, that where we don't have parallel beam, that you use much weaker beam, that it's better for you because you gain by have a better parallelization of the beam. So that's actually a better way that to do, but unfortunately we have some problem there. But the other thing I think when people should really think about is that because the camera, the integration camera and counting camera, they work differently. And then for the K2 camera, if you want to set it in an opposite way, and then it will not be good, because if you try to use shorter exposure and the higher dose rate, basically coincident loss will really damage you. But this would be the similar for the integration camera. Because in the counting camera, one of the things is that because it's counting, therefore there's no readout noise. And all the camera internal frame rate is always fixed. Doesn't matter how many frame you read out. Internally, they have a fixed frame rate. So that for counting camera, you're using long exposure time. There's no penalty by reading out many frame. But because you don't have readout noise. But for the integration camera, way that the longer exposure you go, that because your total signal is fixed, you use lower dose, your total signal is fixed. But then your readout noise actually accumulating will eventually may not be a good thing to do. So in this sense, that for the camera, that for counting camera, this is probably the ideal way to do. And then for integration camera. And then this is the other way is the ideal way. Then you don't go the opposite way. So it's not to say that one camera can do this, the other camera cannot do this, but it's really that what is the best way for each camera you choose to use. So that's actually the only the things that I want to talk about. Then next is wall.
All right, thanks. So when David raised the question what we should talk about today, I raised 6 questions. But since then, I actually forgotten what I told David. So, and then I raised another 6 sets of questions. Anyway, let's start with this. What Microsoft Seminar should be used for high-resolution cryo-EM? That's the kind of thing I've been doing. So now you have heard a lot of physics-based argument why you need to use a direct electron camera. So I am going to kind of evidence-based. So I go to the web, this site called EMDB Data Bank, and then I go to mine the data, which has been published and deposited to the EMDB since 2011. So we are just looking at the facts, whatever in the web. And then I also incorporate some of the things which we have not published but have been done in our lab using this DE camera in a microscope called Joe Microscope, just in case some of you never heard of it. It's made in Japan. So the first questions, I think some of you who are new users, what microscopes are suited for high-resolution structures? So this is a histogram plotting for structures that are done at between 5 to 4 angstroms, 4 to 3.5 angstroms, and better than 3.5 angstroms, and with different types of microscopes, the number of structures. Now, as I classify as 4 types of instruments, 3 of them were FEI, the Creos, Polara, Technite, and the Joe 3200. Now, interesting enough, if you look at the highest possible resolution has been reported at kind of 3.5 angstroms, this in this green color, it looks like the Joe, the Polara, and Creos are capable of doing. So they're kind of reassuring, just in case you have one of these instruments, you are in pretty good shape. Now, you see that the numbers, of course, most people in the community, they were rich, so they all have Creo. So that's why they have more of this. And so the first thing is most modern-day microscopes are perfectly fine if you are just aiming at around 3 to 3.5 angstroms. Now, then the second question is what detectors? Some of you have a lot of money to buy more than one detector. Some have no detectors. But those who have no detector may stretch your head. What detector you want to buy? So here is the data that I've been able to find. And so the numbers of structures saw by different detectors, the DE camera, including the DE12 and DE20, the K2, the Falcon, and I also include the photographic film and the CCD because they are on the EMDB. Now, and as you see, most of the structures solve at better than 5 angstroms are on CCD and on film when they add together. Now, I just want to warn you, when you look at data, you have to be very critical because some of these data that deposited before 2011, they were not based on the gold standard. So somehow the resolution on this range may be somewhat inflated. So now if you're looking at only the data on Falcon, K2, and DE, I think by and large all the data were based on these so-called gold standards. So I think the good news are all these cameras are capable of getting data down to between 3 to 5 angstrom resolution. So I think that you have heard a lot of the K2 and Falcon, so there's another, yes.
It seems
that
the K2 is not capable of 5.
That's a good question. Well, you will see a little bit more slides to explain that. That's why they only do on this 3 or 3.5 angstrom. Now, so because when you interpret this data, you actually keep in mind who did that and what specimens as well, right? So, but I think because we are talking about this, in order to get properties, you need to better than 5 angstrom, I was told. So it's really depressing, but that's life. Now, so then the question you may ask, what defocus you want to use? Now, this is interesting. So again, I break it down according to the detector and number of defocus range. In the EMDB, when you deposit your map to it, you actually need to specify what defocus range. So I mine that data. It looks like all these studies are ranging between half a micron to as far as 5 microns. And you can see, you may ask the questions, why there's some lower defocus, some high defocus. I interpret this as matter of culture. Some lab believe in closer to focus, some lab say, doesn't matter. It just, you can fix it afterwards. So I think the size matter too. That's one reason, but the other would be size reasons too. Yeah, so that's a very good point. So I think, so, but anyway, that ranges, it depends on the size and the specimens and what the boss told you to do, right? A little bit like that. Of course, the boss could be wrong too. But anyway, I think all this microscope is capable of ranging between half to 5 micron, or even, I don't think anybody have go beyond 5 microns. I think that could become a big problem, just too many rings. But, so, the damping function. But somebody told me, I'm a biologist, so somebody told me that don't worry because they are coherent so well. But I always thought, for a long, long time, I disagree with that statement. But since I'm a biologist, I give up. But as a result, what we do is usually much as closer to defocus as possible. That is what we do in general, okay? But there's some school of thought say, doesn't matter, you can go on 4 or 5 microns. But my experience with the Joule microscope, if you go on to higher defocus, the so-called partial coherence, if you don't know what that means, that read Bob Grace's textbooks, and they will explain to you all things about how the EMROC functions or the B factor depending on the defocus. It's a very serious problem. We actually published some of these data more than 10 years ago to point that out. So, but of course, small molecule is also a challenge. Now, the other question is, what type of specimens being studied? And again, I think I validate what Holger talked today. I mean, independent, we discover the same things. Most of them are ribosome, many are virus and other. Now, interesting enough, all the K2 don't seem to like virus at all. They're doing all the oddball things, like membrane proteins and small enzymes and so on. So I think that also reinforced what Yifan said. A lot of these smaller molecules, K2 at the moment, seem to have an evidence they are doing well in that. But of course, there are other cameras doing just okay. I mean, they are able to do that as well. Now, then the other question, which relate to kind of B factors, in other words, how many particles you need? So I summed it in terms of asymmetric unit, which to follow Richard Henderson equations, which he has an equation that relate the number of asymmetric unit and resolution and B factors. So I think these, again, that the smaller the numbers asymmetrically unit is, the better. So I think, interesting enough, both with K2 and Falcon, I think in those examples seem to have much lesser number of asymmetric unit. I think that may be an indication of multiple things. Number of the specimens are good. It could be your algorithms are good, or your microscope is good, or a detector. So it's a number of combinations. But I think this is an observation. I think one of the things that we strive to be better, we want to that number asymmetric unit as further down as possible. So I think detector definitely contribute to that. As you can see, many of the CCD and photographic film there, much not number or asymmetric unit. And so the next question is, what size of specimen can reach to 3 to 5 angstrom? As many of you noted, that in the case of K2, again, because they work on different types of specimens, so their size are much, much smaller compared to what has been done. So I think the interesting phenomenon that I think we continue to observe, whether the other types of cameras can do just and handle this size as a specimen. So, but I think all the others are of relatively bigger size, more than 1 million Daltons. So that's the new question I generated from what I thought about 2 weeks ago. Now, then, when I was sitting there, I feel guilty, so I changed my slide to answer the question I raised 2 weeks ago. And it said, what types of imaging conditions for the, like the DE camera? So these are the kinds of parameter we use. We use using a sampling between 1 and 1.5 angstrom per pixel. The exposure rates 1 to 3 electron per square angstrom. Because we are doing the integrated mode, so we are not restricted by the dose rate. The frame rate is typical. And the total exposure, I think we are basically taking similar routes as some of you. Actually, I saw a poster from Nigo's lab yesterday. They also exposed a long, long time. I think we have been doing that, exposed to more than 100 electron per square angstrom, so multiple frames. So I think this is very convenient to allow us to determine the particle orientation more accurately. And then you can fractionate whatever frame you like to do the reconstruction, usually in the earlier frames. And then because we are doing the counting rate, so the exposure time is smaller. So again, the defocus as well. So I think that is the parameter we do. So I think, as John pointed out this morning, it's useful to be able to make correction in each of the frames. So we independently have actually programmed in the DE camera, we can make corrections in the radiation damage. John pointed out we were too conservative, because I live in Texas, sometimes it's a bit conservative. But on the other hand, one also be a bit worried about in terms of the calibration, the dose rates as well. I think we recently discovered first thing I set up a microscope is to calibrate the dose rate, what the dose rate that we are giving. So it is a possibility. Some of you, when you set up your instrument, you may not take that into consideration. If you don't, whatever B factor or damage weighting factor you put in could be mistaken. So I think somebody asked the questions, if you dose a lot, to enhance the contrast. That's definitely the case that we recently using this procedure we published recently. And this is a GRO-EL, those other types of specimen that I think we want to look into. And definitely with this 100-year trauma, you can see the thing better. So right now, in just literally about less than a week, we can get down to 4 angstrom quite readily. So we also ask the questions, how comfortable some of these detectors? Are they easy to use? Are they user-friendly? So one of the things, as Clint pointed out, it's important to be user-friendly or even automated. So for a long time, I thought a proof of concept is important, but I think in order to compete the rest of you, I think I need high throughput as well. So now, in order to do that, one of the things we did actually to use something program that many of us use is the Serial EMs, which is a very popular software for tomography. So actually, we implemented with the Serial EM, with the DE detector and the Joule microscope. The test specimen we use is a catalase crystal. We took a catalase crystal, and then we do computer transform, and we use those called IQ-Prot that Richard Henderson invented. So I think these are each of the dots correspond to IQ-Prot. So even without any alignment, using the Serial EM actually worked quite well as well. But I just want to make a note that about several months ago, I went to MRC to collect data with Richard together. And I said, well, why didn't we use just these push the button things? You know, Richard said, no, better to use by hand. And I think that day I was sitting in the scope for a long, long, first time for a long time. I think automation is great, but one of the things that we often forgot is different specimen area, it may have different problem with drifting. In other words, by doing by hand, we, Richard and I, observed that some area, you took picture about, 20 pictures, and all of a sudden thing begin to drift, right? You don't know why, but then you need to shift to the other area. I think some of the automation procedure that at least available to us at that time were not available to tell the what stop, move to the next area. So I think the human intelligence at the moment can make that. But of course, one can develop more sophisticated software to take into account with that. So I think the good news is we can probably begin to do high throughput. And now, as we pointed out, one of the problems of this is a lot of data. So I remember some years ago when we heard this famous microscopy called Yoshi Fujiyoshi and Nigel Wanwan, they also always show a stack of photographic film. But I think instead of photographic film, that's what we get now, a stack of hard disks. So it's only one person, we can in a year, about 80 terabyte hard disk. So I think that's a reality. So finally, we'll say, what do we want to future in a camera? I think we pointed out even better development, as David points out, definitely with that curve, that DQE curve, the three manufacturer, four should continue to improve that. Better frame alignment, and John and many others talk about, and we also develop various way of doing more effective alignments. And larger field of view, instead of this small little 3K by 4K, you know, we may want to buy 8K by 8K. I think that would be welcome, particularly one exposure, you have a lot of particles, because sometimes you can't control the concentration of particle on the grid. And David pointed out the data compression is important. I think we are wasting a lot of space unnecessarily. And I think the user-friendly data management is very important. I think we're getting this stack of things. You know, in other words, it would be nice to have a very friendly management, because after a while you would actually would lose track. And finally, I think more affordable camera. I know Bob said there's no such thing. I should say, maybe Bob, maybe we should ask him a senior citizen discount. So of course, all this camera is not, you know, will be damaged and that need to be replenished and so on and so forth. So that's pretty much my.
All right, we'll switch to Karsten.
This is my forward, back, like that.
Yes, so what I would like to do now is to present you a specific case of really from the user perspective where we wanted to compare the performance of a K2 camera with the Falcon 2. And what got us thinking about or started to, that we could actually do this fairly easily was there was a, when we didn't really have access to direct electron detector data yet, was that in Berlin there was a K2 workshop where a number of test specimens were examined, among some TMV, but also ribosomes. And we got a hold of this single micrograph, which you know, had beautiful TMV helices in there, also nice tone rings. And with that, we were able to, you know, with these 10 viruses, that added up to approximately 8,000 asymmetric units, and it allowed us to determine the structure already of 4 angstroms. So this was, in a way, you know, telling us that we could really use this also to get a better understanding from the user perspective, how do these physically measured DQE curves and MTF curves really relate to what we get in the structures. So what we did there, we wanted to, you know, one, of course, one influence is always how do you prepare your specimens, what are your ice thicknesses, and therefore we wanted to have a setup where we could really compare the same grid. And at the MRC LMB, they happen to have, you know, nice Titan cryos, as we heard, and they have 2 cameras installed on one machine. And what we could actually do was measure with the 2 cameras from the same grid in a very similar area, measure a small data set. And so these are the imaging conditions that we decided to do at the time. So, of course, this is all taken at 300 kV. Here, this is to mention that here, this is a post-KIF K2 camera that at the beginning, I guess, wasn't really thought to work for a single particle because most of people were thinking of using that for tomography. And then, of course, the Falcon 2. So in this setup, you have to use rather high magnification to end up with the same similar pixel size here. Here it's to mention that we were using a super resolution mode, a relatively low dose rate, as Yifan already detailed on. And we decided to use total exposure of around 40 electrons. And then that, of course, ends up in higher exposure times. And we wanted to also have a similar amount of frames. No, this is a result of because of the location of the camera. Yes.
No, but the magnification is the pixel size, samples divided by the, or the, the detector pixel size divided by the pixel size on the sample.
Right.
That's what the microscope readout is really calibrated.
Right? Okay, yes. No, that's true. But it is important to... This is exactly, I mean, you have to use it in different imaging mode, right?
Yeah, so. Mm-hmm.
Yes, but it's, you're absolutely right, it's in after mode, so there's also different lens settings that are being used. But I guess it's the type of setting that you would practically try to use. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, the nice thing about helical specimens is that you can actually already look at the 2D transforms without performing 3D reconstructions, and this is what is done here. So this is these are collapsed power spectra, so you're averaging along the layer lines. And what you can see here is that the signal extends already in these few images. So this is about 25 micrographs and then picked segments from there. And you see that meridional reflection is approximately at 4.6 angstrom that you can already see from the raw data. And now the 3D reconstructions, they go to a resolution of 4 angstrom in the K2 and 3.7 for the Falcon 2. If you look at the two maps, they are really very similar in quality. I can't see so much difference. So you see nice separation of beta sheets. But you also see very nice helical density. So now what are the differences? So for this type of specimen, high molecular weight, I believe the differences are really, really small. And maybe the slight difference here does reflect the better DQE at these high resolutions. But what is certainly different is the exposure times, and therefore also the type of movements that you have in the sample. So these are now tracks that have been calculated via the motion core program, and you can see that in this K2 we have significantly larger movements as opposed to the Falcon 2, and I guess that's not surprising. If you plot this now, the shift that you have per frame as a function of time, we see the distribution into these two regions. We have a first relatively large movement that appears to settle at relatively low. But you can also see now in the Falcon 2, since we are using also similar amount of frames, we have a much higher sampling of this area. Now, if you normalize this basically against the dose, what you get is actually a very similar type of movement. You have here, it should be noted that in the Falcon 2 cases, we have a little bit less data because we have these roll-in, roll-out frames, and this is dictated by the internal frame rates of the camera. Now, I want to also draw attention to one other aspect that hasn't been discussed, but I think it came up last night in the poster session. So that's concerning the radiation damage. The term has been used throughout the meeting a number of times, but I think as we now see really the structures, we realize that there is a lot more than just radiation damage. But let me explain this a little bit more in detail. So this is from now a larger data set taken entirely on the Falcon. This is at a resolution approximately 3.3 angstroms. And now we can also compute a relatively large data set with 400,000 asymmetric units. We can now compute individual reconstruction of individual frames. And now what you should see here is a movie, but it doesn't really show here. Anyway, what you will see is that now you can basically calculate the resolution as you get it as a function of dose. And this is plotted here, and we have slightly worse resolution because of the movement at the beginning. Then we go down, we have this optimum at the second frame. This case was only 7 frames, and then it goes up and it deteriorates rather. So we have a general decline in resolution, that's clear. These densities become tubular. But if we examine the densities more closely, and so this is what you were supposed to see here. So this is from the very first frame. Here you see lots of details. You see nice, all the side chains are basically visible. Now, if you monitor this, now you do atomic model building and you do a real space correlation of individual residues, it's clear that the main chain basically also deteriorates, but we have really a different behavior of the kind of decline in detail. So this means that negatively charged residues, they certainly decline significantly, whereas others are there a lot longer. And I guess this is also one of the differences now in the maps. We have been talking about how good our maps look in comparison with X-ray crystallography, and certainly one example has already been shown. Is this stuck now? It's spinning. It's rather loud. Can you have a look? Because it's basically the spinning wheel. I'm just trying to forward here. But is it possible that it got stuck?
Yeah. Not so good.
Okay, this was the last slide. Anyway, I just want to... No, I mean, I had... After that, there's one slide which I can try to summarize briefly.
Yeah.
Because it is showing people from other results and pictures that we have seen. So one of the images, for example, in the publication from Yifan Cheng on the proteasome shows the direct comparison of the X-ray map versus the EM map. And what is striking there visually already is that also the negative side chains are basically gone in comparison to the X-ray map where they're perfectly present. So we are saying we have, you know, in comparison to X-ray, I guess we are still imaging already a state that has a much higher degree of radiation damage, although it's side chain specific. And a similar observation has been made in, from Siram's lab on the beta galactosidase data, and there's also a poster on that. But in the end, I think there was a paper already in 2000 from X-ray crystallography where exactly this very similar effect has been observed by testing different frames. And it looks like the effects of radiation damage are actually very similar to the one in the M case. But I guess it does raise the question whether we should be even more conservative and only include the very first 10 electrons or 7 electrons where we don't have this type of damage. But this is, of course, at the moment the data that's most heavily moving. So this is where we still need to, where we have work to do, I guess, to figure this out. Okay.
Great. Thanks, Carsten. Sorry about that.
Okay, my contribution. So at LMB, we are in the fortunate position to have two of the cameras on the same microscope. As Carsten just said, we have a post-GIF K2 on our cryos and a pre-GIF Falcon. And on our Polara, we also have a Falcon. Okay. This is the plot you've seen several times before. That one, yeah. So, as Greg and David have pointed out, the K2 doing counting has a much higher DQE at the lower frequencies, and for the moment at least, the Falcon 2 is slightly better at the higher frequencies in integrating mode, especially if you consider that this blue curve, which Greg measured for the K2, was actually measured at a quite a low, much lower dose rate than people often use it. So I showed this dotted line, which has nothing to do with the truth, but the blue curve will come somewhat down if you use the typical 8 or 10 electrons per pixel per second dose rate that many people use. Now, based on this observation and on the observation that if you have particles that are relatively small and the contrast in the images decreases, then the actual lower frequencies in your data are very important for alignment. If your particle is very large, and that means, for example, a ribosome or a virus, then those low frequency data in your images is more or less strong enough to align anyway. So for that reason, we came up with this, and I think that's what David referred to. So let me clarify that. Okay. First, what I would do is not really. I embarrassingly don't know how to use a cryo, so I hardly know how to use a spirit. So this is what I would suggest people at LMB to do. Okay. If you have a relatively large particle, and that we've kind of seen that beta galactosidase, which is a bit under half a megadalton, still goes quite well on the Falcon, then we advise people to use a Falcon. Not because it's not possible on the K2, and that's what David referred to. It's just if your DQE is lower, but you can align your particles well, you just need a few more particles to get to the same resolution. Okay, this is all about a throughput. Because our microscopes are now being used by 50 or 60 people, we're moving much more towards a situation where many projects, the actual microscopy isn't so limiting. You don't need to do the absolute best you can, and we really want to get throughput. How many 3-angstrom structures can I get out of one scope in each week? And if you optimize that, then we find that doing larger things on the Falcon is more efficient. We have two of them, that's for a start, whereas we only have one K2, okay? But also data collection is significantly faster on the Falcon than on the K2, especially if you use super resolution mode. So, but the smaller particles, and then if you go significantly under half a megadalton, we see that there are just not as good structures on the Falcon as on the K2. So then we use our more scarce resource of using the K2. So that was my clarification of that. Okay, so I thought it might be useful if I just tell you what we typically do in terms of data collection and then also with the focus on the subsequent imaging. So on the Falcon 2, I have to mention that Greg actually hacked our Falcon, and we're very grateful for that because we get access to all the 17 frames a second, whereas I think the standard FEI solution gives you 7 frames a second. Okay, so my views are slightly skewed perhaps towards this capability. Okay, now we either do EPU data collection or manual data collection. So we don't have Legion, we only have EPU, and that gives us large data sets with lots of sleep, so this is very good, so the people can go home to sleep. But yeah, I think because of what Wah just mentioned, that if you're in an area, some areas have beam-induced drift to a much larger extent than other areas. And if you're a human, then you can observe that and move away to another area which is better and take more better images during your 24-hour shift that we use. Whereas EPUs, at least in its current implementation, is not capable of picking up on that, and it will just keep in the bad area with lots of beam-induced drift and take bad picture after bad picture. So you get bigger data sets, but there is also more particles on more images that you then have to remove. So, and then there's really two types of users in at LMB. The new users who are less comfortable on the microscope do then a lot of EPU. And I think the more advanced users with more experience, they think they can get more good images out of a manual data collection session. But I guess the future lies in automation, and it's just a matter of time until these kind of EPU programs or whatever you use will be able to actually make those kind of intelligent decisions as data come in. Okay. So if you do manual data collection, then actually the expert microscopist makes decisions on the fly which images to save and which images to throw away, so that also some of the decisions that you have to do here later behind your computer are done on the fly in the microscope. Okay. So for the K2, we have to collect manually because EPU does not work with the K2, unfortunately. Okay. So again, not much sleep, but good small data sets with good quality images. For processing, once you have collected your data then, okay, now we go more in my area of expertise. Before, when we were mainly collecting data on the Falcon, we didn't use Xiuming's program of motion core. We started doing this when we started working really with K2 data, and then gamma secret days was the first thing that we really seriously worked on. But now, also if we use our Falcon, we still use the motion core program. I think it's a beautiful piece of software which gives very nice, robust results. And just realigning your frames in the beginning makes your power spectra better, your CTF estimation will be better, your initial alignments of particles and so on will all go better. So things to monitor are then the improvements of your tone rings. I think people should look at these tracks that come out of motion core, see if they kind of make sense. I'm not sure everyone does at LMB. Okay. So, and then the second step of just a single particle approach is what we then do is rely on processing, which actually uses then a wrapper to an EcoCTF find for CTF estimation. And then we do the classification, 2D sorting, removing many junk particles, do some 3D classification. And then we do a refinement of all the particles that have survived this initial classification procedure, which is mainly getting rid of junk. So at this point, we don't really get rid of a lot of different conformations, but we make a consensus reconstruction with all the particles that we think are ribosomes or gamma secretase molecules or whatever we happen to be working on. Okay? Because then in the third step, we will do a per-particle movie refinement, and John kind of explained this already this morning, where we use a projection of this consensus model, which is relatively clean, to realign all these movie frames of individual particles with respect to the reference. And we used to do this with both rotations and translations for ribosomes. And that's because for ribosomes or bigger viruses, for example, you can determine rotations accurately enough to actually follow rotational beam-induced rotation throughout the movies. If you go to smaller particles, and already a 70S ribosome, we see that's getting a bit more difficult, then the accuracy in alignment is just not enough to do that, and it's not even worth doing it. Okay. Now, then we do some kind of... What we now do for smaller particles, and even some people use it just still for the ADS ribosomes, is therefore only do translations, and then we do similar things as John mentioned this morning. We average over particles that are in neighboring each other in the micrographs, and we do this particle polishing, which is similar perhaps to also what Wa just referred to, radiation damage weighting. So we can take relatively long exposures and downweight the higher frequencies in the later frames where you know where radiation damage has set up. But I'll speak more about that in tomorrow. So at this point, we realign all the movie frames of our particles, add them together, and then we have our shiny particles, as we call them, or polished particles, and then we remove all these terribly big movies from the disk. Okay? And I think one of the conceptually nice things of, for example, John's approach, which would be to do this all before you do any kind of 3D refinement and remove the movies straight from the disk rather than first having to do a 3D refinement and then remove the movie from the disk, will be better on your disk. So that's a definite advantage, I think, of John's approach. So it may well be that the actual advantage of using a clean reference to realign your movie frames isn't that important, And then getting rid of those movies very early on would be actually quite a big advantage. But we'll see where things go. And now the thing is that now we start doing more 3D classification and refinement. Because now these polished particles have increased signal-to-noise ratio, and we just saw some beautiful examples of Gruyao in Wa's pictures. So you can actually align better, and you can also classify better. So whereas before, classification was more or less only selecting the particles that we were interested in, now we're going to try and find different conformations and refine each of those different conformations to high resolution. So it's a slightly different way of working than we used to do. Okay, and this was just finally to show result for gamma secretase. So we got a 5-angstrom map just by using the motion core program on the K2 data. And this is just to show that then afterwards still doing per particle alignment and this polishing can make it still better. So I think the combination of whole frame alignment with some per particle alignment and this radiation correction will be powerful. Okay. So to finish, we think this is still not enough because 4.5 sounds really nice and we were really thrilled. And then we started building a model and then we found that 4.5 is really not good enough to build a de novo atomic model, okay? Even though maps may look better than X-ray maps, 4.5 just doesn't cut it if you don't know what's in there. So we wanted to make things better, and I thought perhaps we could do a little quiz. How to do things better? I think just putting in more data is a very steep hill to climb for any project if you want to make your structure significantly better, given that you have already done quite a bit of amount of work in imaging. Because just doubling your data sets, you can do once, and then you get tired, and you can do it another time, you get very tired. But then doing it again, you might run out of your time. So just taking more images is difficult. I think it's much more efficient to increase the signal-to-noise ratio in each of your particles. That's much more powerful if you want to make a given reconstruction better. So this is what we used for gamma secretase that we published, the 4.5-angstrom map. 1.8 angstrom per pixel. We didn't do super resolution on the K2. We used this dose rate, total electron dose of 38 electrons per squared angstrom. We didn't have the energy filter slits in because somehow we had some artifacts there, and we saved 15 frames. So to make every particle better, and I guess that kind of fits in nicely with what you've all just said, but the DQE curve of the K2 keeps on dropping, so you can just crank up your mag and all your images will become better. Okay? Now that has a limit because you can crank it up a lot, but then you won't have many particles per field of view, so your throughput goes down, but it's a very efficient way. We switched on super resolution counting, went down in the dose rate to 5 electrons per pixel per second, put the energy filter slit in, and also, I think the total dose is a bit higher, perhaps not, okay. But hopefully, this will make every particle better, and I'm confident we can make a gamma secretase reconstruction better with that, although that work is still pending. Okay.
Is this super resolution pixel, or just a pixel?
Physical pixel, yes. So the physical pixel, we went from 1.74 to 1.4. We could go up even higher, but throughput goes down. So that was the... Yes. So the consideration is throughput and access to microscope time. Okay, that was it. So, can you guys come up here? You want to just sit here?
Yeah, otherwise, if you don't want to do that, I can bring the chairs up. Yeah. But if you can sit there, it's easier.
Yeah. Question? This is for Professor Chen. So you were talking about your collection, your preferable mags. And so when you're using large molecules that are larger, like in the millidalton ranges, not only like you might have to take 80 frames, but those aren't going to be processable like in a program like Reliant, where the memory requirements are so large, if your particle box sizes become extremely large. Like you're taking like 512, like 1,000 particle or pixel box sizes. So what do you suggest in that situation?
Sorry, can you repeat exactly? I didn't really get the condition. Good question.
It's just how do, on the K2 camera, how do you handle large specimens? Where if you are, if you need to be using some a magnification like 31K, your box size of your particles will become so large that they will stop fitting in memory for these new 3D classification
this
programs.
This is I don't think this is the important thing is that the pixel size determines your Nyquist resolution. So it doesn't matter how big is molecule. And for example, if we, like the mag we're using now is a 1.2 angstrom pixel size, then my Nyquist is 2.4. And if we're talking for 3 angstrom, I'm quite close to Nyquist. So I would not want to go lower, and I would rather go higher. But of course, go higher is going to be you have a problem of the throughput is even lower. So this doesn't matter what big things I would look at. I would still stick with this this magnification. So even you look at the virus or look at the some large object, probably if your target resolution is around like 3 angstrom, then you better stay with this one, or even you want to go higher magnification. So go lower is not a good option, unless one can start using the super resolution on pixel.
But, then but I think the problem is these things don't fit into Reliant's memory. You can't even process them.
Yeah. Then you have the bin.
Can I comment on that?
But I think that was the question.
Yeah, so if your physical Nyquist is very small, or your physical pixel size is very small because of DQE considerations, but you're very far away from that in your resolution of reconstruction. So if you have a 1 angstrom pixel, you get a 2 angstrom Nyquist, and you think, oh, I'm not going to get beyond 3 angstroms, you might do Fourier cropping, downsampling of your images, and put them rather in an 800 pixel box into a 500 pixel box. And that way you will have a new Nyquist which is closer to your target resolution. So the processing in Reliant is quite okay up to 90 or 95% of Nyquist before some interpolation artifact starts happening. So you can put Nyquist pretty close to your target resolution, and that will save a lot of memory.
You can use any number.
Yeah. This question is for for maybe three, maybe two or three speakers. Sirius and Carsten, you guys talk about the comparison between the K2 and the Falcon 2 cameras. So as Yifan pointed out very nicely, that you have to use each of those cameras, the conditions that are made to be used. K2 is supposed to be under the counting mode, and the Falcon 2 should be integrated mode. So my question to you is, are those comparisons done under the supposed conditions, namely K2 for under using its counting mode and the Falcon 2 as integrated mode? Are those done that way? So if you use the K2 as a counting mode, which is not supposed to do that according to Yifan, what is? Oh, yeah, it's the integrated mode.
Yeah,
but if you actually use the other way around, so what would you...
My point is that
No, yeah. That's why you cannot compare the two data to put them on exactly operating condition, because that's what make one better one. Yeah.
And they've got different pixel sizes.
Yeah. So there's no way you can do that. Yeah.
Hi guys, Cindy Schwartz from RML. I just wondered. I have this naive assumption that the GIF is really only helpful energy filtering on thick samples, like in tomography and things like this. Is this something that I just have wrong, or I noticed you guys have your K2s behind the filter.
I think energy filter will always help, particularly to improve the contrast. And I remember Koji Yonekula, when he was at the UCSF a few years ago, and he looked at the flagella, right? Yes. Bacterial flagella, which is quite a thin filament. And then his calculation was about 8 or 11% gain in contrast. And even for very thin samples. So there is a gain. The only thin problem is that it's harder to use for single particle. And then most of this automated program, it doesn't work very well. And then also, you guys use the all manual data collection, right?
Yes.
Using the GIF. So that's it's harder to use. And like us, that John also mentioned that we like to use we don't have constant power lens. So we like to use a diffraction mode for the search mode, which is almost impossible to work with the GIF. So then you have to switch to the normal mode and normal sort of imaging mode. Then your search mode have to go very, not has necessarily go lower magnification, really high defocus, almost 100, 200 micron defocus to gain. So those are the things that it could change. You're going back and forth. So we're not doing this montage thing. So if we do, so there's a complication there. So practically it's harder to do, but if one can manage to do it, it should be better.
It has an in-column energy filter, which is pretty trivial to use.
I think there's three questions. Yeah. One day.
I'm not sure who this question's for. It might also be for Bob Glazer or Greg. One of the consequences of taking a counting mode image is that you need to use a very dim beam. That means you demagnify the source, and you should improve the coherence of the microscope. Has anybody calculated how much of a benefit you'd assume you might gain at typical defocuses that we use?
A different defocus?
Well, the coherence will be more important the more out of focus you go. So for the typical defocuses that we use, let's say 3 microns, how much of a benefit do you get from the improved coherence of the...
Well, this is very obvious. If you change your condenser aperture from, say, 30 micrometer to 50, and you will see very obvious, same, if you take an image at exactly the same defocus, you will see the tongue wind in the smaller apertures go much better. So this
is
same.
Are you changing the strength of the condenser lens? Because then you'll also be changing how parallel your beam is.
Well, you can make a beam dimmer. You can do both, or you can use a higher, smaller spot size, which change improve also smaller then. Condenser aperture.
Yeah. I think the best experiment to do is just take a focus series of carbon film under different conditions, then you can convince yourself.
You'd have to say one on the Falcon and one on the K2.
Oh, to do that comparison, that I don't know. You're saying that, so John's saying that the comparison of Falcon, which you use high dose, because then you use a high dose rate, then you use a very strong, larger condenser aperture, and then versus a small one, which because you gain. And then in Titan, I guess that doesn't matter. Exactly, we use the smallest one.
Yeah.
Yes.
You can ask whether that has a significant effect or not at 2 or 3 microns.
Yeah.
So Greg McMillan showed that the Falcon has a good DQE, but not so good MTF. And my question is for all the image processing guys. Will noise whitening improve, say, the subframe alignment or particle alignment or the reline processing in any way, or it doesn't matter?
Relion will estimate power spectrum of noise for every micrograph, and it will divide the square difference between references and experimental particles by that power spectrum. So it basically does some sort of chi-square weighting. So it should be invariant to whitening or non-whitening. In practice, it isn't completely, but the effect seems to be not very large. And rely on the same thing. I don't know for motion core.
From our experience, we have been using motion core on the Falcon 2 data, and I think a lot of others have successfully. So I don't think there's a big difference. We use, for our processing anyway, low-pass filters for the alignment of the data, and that's what essentially matters. And then later on, you're doing a B-factor sharpening with your reconstruction. So our low-pass filters are around 9 angstroms, and so that's what matters mostly.
Yeah, in motion core, you actually use another big B factor, so it's kind of being filled. Yeah, but so it's probably not a big deal, is what it amounts to.
Sorry for the delay, but I wanted to come back to Cindy's question. I'm not a tomography specialist by any mean, by any stretch, but I thought that the thicker the sample, the larger your inelastic cross section. Right. So if you keep your window, your slit to 0 to 20 EV, in that zero loss window, there's not going to be any signal. So I ran a lot of tomography. People bring over samples to Nissen that are half a micron or thicker. And with those samples, if you put the slit in, you don't see anything anymore. So why do you guys keep saying that having an energy filter helps?
No, that's
by putting a wrong position. No, it's in the zero loss. You want to do zero loss, right?
Well, we do from the zero, it's a width of a slit, right? If you just only go zero plus or minus 0.1 electron.
No, I said 0 to 20.
Yeah, and that's what we do routinely for tomography.
Yeah, but if you have a sample that is half a micron or thicker,
you
don't see anything anymore.
We do. No, we do.
Unless you crank up the dose and your structure is burned.
No, you don't need to. It's not a problem.
So, I mean, in the end, you know, as you go wider and wider slit, obviously, you can get more and more counts, electrons, through the slit. But then you start having increasing chromatic aberration as well as, I guess that's probably the biggest thing, you know, initially. But if you call it, 20 versus 25, it depends in the end where your target resolution is. And, you know, John could talk about this perhaps for when you're going for, John Briggs, for when you're trying to go out to high resolution. A lot of tomography is sort of in the 20 angstrom range. And so it probably doesn't hurt much to go a little bit wider and slit at that resolution.
You're talking about the very thick sample.
Yeah.
Yes, I said half a micron, and above. And if you put in the slit, you can't see anything anymore. Well, I get better signal on the Falcon without the filter.
Contrast is no longer phase contrast.
But that's what I said at the very beginning.
It's all amplitude contrast.
That's what I said at the very beginning.
Yeah. Then it's not the, you're not aiming for anything high resolution. You basically just take a picture.
But by better
signal, you get then a better signal if you actually remove the slit.
Well, by better signal, do you just mean more counts?
Sorry?
By better signal, do you just mean more counts?
Well, because in the zero loss window, there's not going to be any counts anymore.
Yeah, but then you shouldn't be doing tomography on that specimen.
There's always a limit for how thick sample you can go.
Yeah, of course you can. Then you can do stem tone.
Yeah, 50 sample, that's it.
Okay. Yeah, I had a comment on the alignment of individual particles and whether it makes more sense to use a model versus just an average from the images. And I think there are cases where one is better and where another one is better. So Tim, when he worked on rotavirus, I think found that it is better to just use the average calculated from the images because presumably the RNA in that virus contributes to that signal when you line it, whereas in the model it is disordered and therefore doesn't really contribute much features. And I can imagine that other things like defocus and so on that may have, where the estimation might have an error, but obviously when you just take the image itself, you don't have that, or flexibilities, amplifold rings, whatever, all that stuff that you don't really have accurate in your reconstruction. If these, well, these can play a role and can therefore give different results, make it better in the when you use the average from the image.
Maybe one more question from Fred, and then take a break. And at 4 o'clock,
I have one more question.
Oh, all right.
Okay, so Shores is doing what we've all been afraid to do, which is throwing away the movies. It sounds like once you've polished your particles, you actually go and erase those movie files and just use, I guess this is a particle stack, or this is a movie particle stack where you have a movie of each particle. What is it that you keep?
So let me clarify. We don't chuck it in the bin. We first put it on one of these USB disks that Wa also showed.
Okay, I think so you're afraid too.
We keep two copies of it, but we have little hope it will survive 5 years of time. But so what we keep are the particles which have been realigned and damage weighted. But yeah, we don't yet just delete the data. We put them on one of these.
So a year disks. Or two ago,
you keep your raw damage. Raw, original raw data?
Yeah, that's the raw micrographs, yeah.
Do you, a couple of years ago, you were doing this statistical particle alignment on your ribosomes. Do you now replace this with just the alignment of the particles to the models that you describe now? In your eLife ribosome?
Yeah, so the eLife 2013, we do rotations and translations. Oh. Now we use the same algorithm, but only integrate over translations. We forget about rotations, because if you only do translations, then you can actually realign your particle stack and calculate these, what we call shiny particles. Yeah. If you have beam-induced rotations and you can follow them, that you can't model in the average of a particle, right? Sorry.
So just quickly, one question that was a write-in. The question is, does your direct detector collect dust? Where does the dust come from, and how will it affect the results? That this has been a practical problem that you know I think more and more people are facing with these detectors as they're going to higher and higher sensitivities, that they're actually sensitive to junk that falls on the detector. And, you know, the reality is that, you know, and this may be where a GIF becomes very good because it puts the detector at 90 degrees and so stuff won't fall on it. But, you know, really the microscope column should probably be horizontal and not vertical so that, you know, we don't accumulate this. But what are practical experiences that people have had and, you know, are there any useful solutions? Because often trying to get rid of the dust has led to damaging of the detector in the process.
Yes. Yeah. No. It's a comment. You know, the screen is a likely place for stuff to come from. Are there any other sources?
I just want to describe our experience. At one point, one of our K2 camera had a piece of, I would call it a hair. Dropped onto it, and only one end of it stick onto the sensor. So the other end is floating around. So during the experiment, it will move around. So it's really, really annoying. So at one point, we had a problem with the camera. So the technician from Catan came over, and he had to invert the camera in order to work on its backside, and it fell off. One of the things that he told us is that if you have something that falls onto it, the best thing that we can do is annealing it often, because it will keep it from getting stuck on it. And so that would be. So apparently it's more likely for a piece of, if you have something falls onto it, and if it's a stay cold and it's been radiation damaged for too long, it's more likely to stay on and not to come off. And when we heard that, we keep on doing that. We normally do annealing anyway, but it did fall off during his service. So that's some of the things that, you know, for us, if you go in and out many times, a lot of time they will shift if they are not actually stuck on. So that's our experience.
How often do you do
annealing? We do annealing pretty much at the end of every data collection. For us, that would mean maybe a day or two or whatever.
And obviously, the important thing is to collect gain references really quite often on the K2. That's a big deal. So just to make that
When we capture the frames, we automatically store the gain references. So I look at the gain references over time, and you notice accumulation of features as the small bits fall on. We've also taken our detectors in and out a few times, and you see what would be called hairs on there. A couple of times they've been able to be removed because they were safe enough to touch, but with the back-thinned Falcon detector, you can watch it watch a reflected light on it, and it's acting as a microphone. So you don't really want to touch or blow it. Also, there's 2,000 bump-bonded wires around the outside that are unprotected. So you do not want to put a blow. If you blow it with an air gun, you will destroy it. So you can try and shake it off by tipping it over and being very careful. But they're usually stuck on by electric. They're quite well bonded to your detector by the time then the beam has welded them on there, and they don't come off. So it depends how long you...
Can you comment on the oil grade?
Yeah, we used to have a Junair system that leaked oil into our system. So we had first Falcon 2 was absolutely covered in this. We moved to a new building, and we've got a beautiful system with no Junair. The compressor is miles away. And what happened, the detector cleaned up. But then, so we were going to do, we thought it might be diffusion pump oil, so I put a job in the workshop to make a cold filter to stop any diffusion pump oil going through. But then it probably came from the Aureus camera and the Junair flushing bits of oil in. But when we moved to the new building, it basically dried up and cleared off. And then that detector has actually failed on us. And when we took it off, there was actually no sign. There was dried up oil on it, remnant or whatever. But it didn't have, when we moved building and looked at it, it had like a completely covered in oil. No. Well, the Falcon doesn't actively clean. When you turn off the cooling, it'll go up to 38 degrees.
Can you talk louder so that everybody can share that question?
Yep. Do you think heating it to 50 degrees, like what happened? We've also seen oil on an old CCD we had. Do you think that heating the a K2 would evaporate the oil?
I have no experience with the K2. I've never taken it off.
You know, it will certainly help, and that's one of the benefits you get with annealing. It'll depend a lot on how baked into the surface it is. And if it's particles from the screen, they won't come off, obviously, with I guess we have to wrap up. Is that right?
If you want a coffee break, otherwise you can just keep going to the next panel.
I go for the coffee break. Let's come back. We'll go 15 minutes late. Yeah, thank you to everybody. Be back when the bell rings.